Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Gorgeous Reads. I am speaking with Sarah Schmidt, debut author of See What I Have Done. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Lizzie Borden took an axe.
Indeed she did.
Yes.
Many times.
Yes. As an American, that is a very familiar rhyme, children's rhyme, and Lizzie Borden took an axe. How does the rest go? Hit her mother with 40
wax. The 40 wax. And when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41, which is actually inaccurate. It was, I think Abby got 18 blows to the head and her father got 12. But, you know, it doesn't rhyme as well.
Exactly. It doesn't scan.
No.
It doesn't scan. We like the 40 and the 41.
I don't know. Overblown is good.
Yeah. Yep. And it is one of those stories for Americans, maybe of my generation, that, you know, unexamined, you just sort of know.
Yeah.
But not for you.
No.
Tell me how you came to this story.
Okay. Well, I had, I'd never heard of her. And the only way that I ever met her was quite a few years ago, I was working on another novel about the Hollywood blacklist. So I have this thing about America, I think. and it was going nowhere and was awful. And as it should have, I was only 20-something. So, you know, what did I know? So I went to a secondhand bookstore to try and find something to maybe write about or just to, you know, get my mind off something, you know, this book was awful. And so I was walking around and I found myself drifting over to the true crime section, which I normally go to, but I don't really tell anyone that that's what I do. And so I reached up for a book and a pamphlet fell off the shelf and I picked it up and it was about the Lizzie Borden case. And it was very sensationalized. It was, you know, had things like, you know, she committed the crime in naked and on the wall was written in blood was a, you know, a ransom note, which there wasn't. But so it was very kind of over the top. And I got to the end and I thought, this does not, like, I'm not interested in this at all. And I kind of closed it and it was $20. Who wants to spend $20 on that? And I didn't. And so I put it back on the shelf and then that was it. And I think I ended up buying a book about Poltergeist or something. And then I went home. But it wasn't until that night that I had my chance again to meet Lizzie and I had a dream about her. She was sitting on the edge of my bed and she was poking me in the legs, telling me, I have something to tell you about my father. He has a lot to answer for. It was one of the creepiest dreams I've ever had in my life. And I woke up thinking, oh my God, what the hell was that? It was so real and vivid. And I just, like, I had this feeling inside my body that that was not normal.
And I just got chills.
And so I ignored her. And then every single night for a week, she just kept coming back. And I felt then that perhaps there was something in this that I was picking up on that, you know, consciously I wasn't, but there was something else going on. And so I thought, okay, what I'll do is I'll start writing down the dreams and then they'll leave me alone and then life will go on and that will be fine. But of course, that's not what happened. And that was actually the beginning of the book. So, yes.
Oh my goodness.
She took me.
So yes, she as and okay, so let's talk about the book because I think what you're that experience infused the book.
I think so, yeah. And it made, I think if anything, and you know, I think we can all pay attention to our dreams, particularly if you are a creative person, that I think that really, you know, upon reflection, that sense of just people being right there, you know, and that intimacy obviously was something that, you know, I was interested in anyway. So it just kind of led me down this path. And I think once you make a choice in your book, these other things happen. So you just have to keep going. So, yeah, that was what happened.
Yes. Okay. So, and how did you, since, I mean, she came and haunted you, practically,
yeah.
Or perhaps did. And so where did you, did you start researching her?
I did.
I was going to say, what was your way in?
So after, I mean, her voice was very strong in my head. There was just this kind of, you know, another thing too, you know, the version of Lizzie that I had heard was almost a childlike person. And I think when, and even particularly when I read the pamphlet, they made it sound like her and her older sister Emma were these young women, girls almost, you know, teenagers living in this house. And it wasn't until I went and did some research that I realised that actually Lizzie was 32 years old and Emma was 42. And so I just, and then the voice that I had in her about how she was, it just made me feel like, okay, so we have almost like an arrested development almost. So what is that all about? And so I started just reading a little bit about more about what happened, the actual case. And so that just involved reading some transcripts and, you know, going over the evidence. So that's how I kind of walked myself through it all. And I kind of stopped doing that when I realised that the story I wanted to tell was more about the family and not so much about the crime and the trial. As fascinating as it is, I wanted to know, I wanted to look at the conditions that would perhaps make someone do this. So that's how I started. And I would just go back and forth when I needed some more real information and then, yeah, go on.
Because it's one of those events that, like, okay, so first of all, we're fascinated by true crime.
Yes.
Because that was done by people.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be done by people we know. That could be done by ourselves.
Yes.
That could be, you know, we're endlessly fascinated by the extremes of human experience.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. We're also really fascinated and frightened by women not behaving as they should.
Yeah.
You know, these are spinster girls. What are they doing?
What's wrong with them?
What's wrong with them?
Yep.
They're not acting properly. You know, we just... someone made a comparison with your book and the story of, like, Amanda Knox recently.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting
I thought
case.
That was a very interesting comparison because the picture that you make of Lizzie is somebody who doesn't necessarily sort of understand the import of her actions, and she's sort of preoccupied with domestic issues and herself.
Yes, and, I think she's very much about herself. And I, you know, as I was kind of going along, I kind of thought of how, as someone who, I'm interested in dualities and how we might be feeling on the inside and how we present ourselves on the outside, you know. And in real life, one of the things that people kept saying about Lizzie and why she did it was that she was so emotionless. And there could be many reasons why that was. One, she was on morphine almost the entire time to calm her down. But maybe,
of the trial.
Yeah. But also, and in that, there's this idea that you have to show emotion in one way. And so, you know, we expect, particularly with women, that if they're grieving, they have to be outwardly doing it. And I thought, well, maybe some part of her might have been internally doing that. But what she chose to show on the outside was, you know, just quite stoic. Or maybe she didn't give a crap.
A monkey.
You know, and so it was all fine. And so I just wanted to keep playing with that. And so I do think, though, that that kind of, that fear of women being a particular way, out of control, and, you know, I think that does speak a lot to it. So I found that interesting. So the more I kind of wanted to play with that, the more I just thought, well, maybe she killed them, maybe she liked it, and maybe she doesn't care, who knows, you know. So I just kind of, you know, went down that path. But, yeah, I think, you know, also too with the women, I think this was particular with how it was happening at the time, that it wasn't so much that a woman did this, it was a woman of wealth did this. So who's to say what, you know, lower class women could do? So I think that was just really feeding the frenzy.
Yeah. Because I mean, as I said, my mother came from Boston, from New England. If you're not familiar with this, it's like being from the north of England. You know, this very puritanical, upright, judgmental, the Scarlet Letter, Ethan Frome, these houses frozen in winter, locked in this turgid pressure cooker of a house.
Yeah.
Like, you really create that atmosphere. Their father has remarried.
Mm. How dare he?
Yeah. And she can't have children, or doesn't.
Yes. Well, she, when Abby and Andrew got married, now, I could have this wrong. This is just, I'm going through memory, but I think she was about 36 years old when she got married, which, you know, she may as well have been over it. And so maybe she couldn't have children. Maybe she didn't want to, having those two girls as your daughters might have. But
birth control enough.
Yeah, but I, you know, I don't think they were always kind of like that. I think it was something that kind of manifested. But yeah, they did not appreciate a new woman in their life.
No. As well as the fact that Lizzie seems to have... One, they've also been locked into these roles because their mother died, because when they were young, because Emma, the older daughter, is 10 years older than Lizzie, because there was another child who died at birth, because of these sort of intractable, they feel locked into their situations. And also, you know, and Emma is the caregiver and Lizzie's the baby of the family. Even at 32. But she also appears in your working of it to have sort of mental predilection, disorder, condition that we recognize more now.
Yeah, which is interesting because I don't think I ever thought of her as being, you know, having... anything like some people said, oh, well, that just, you know, you must have done work looking at sociopaths. I'm like, no, actually, I just wrote the way
that, on the spectrum.
Yeah. And I just, and I didn't, you know, maybe didn't, well, for this book anyway, I didn't feel that that was helpful. I went with what the character wanted. So sometimes to me, she would be completely sane wrong, but completely sane about some things. And then, you know, I just felt that she couldn't. Maybe she was living this world constantly within herself where she was just going on this cycle. And so sometimes that's when you would see the child like, in, you know, the child like Lizzie, and then you would find, you know, all, you know, the variants in there. And I think sometimes, you know, maybe this is way too much of a giveaway, but sometimes I feel like I'm, you know, I sometimes look in the mirror and I can't believe I'm not 15. And I know that's, I'm not saying I want to be 15, but sometimes I think you can feel like inside your body, particularly when, I don't know, when you're, there's an experience and you recall something to your youth and then you go, yeah, I remember what that feels like. And then, but your present day, you are not this. And so I just, you know, maybe I think that's something that we all do, but I just, yeah, that was something. So if Lizzie's crazy, then maybe I am. But yeah, that's how I kind of constantly saw her as someone who, you know.
Okay, and the story is told through four voices.
Yes.
Tell us about the four voices.
The four voices are, well, so then there's Emma, who's the next one. So she's the older sister who, poor Emma, had to kind of look after this awful person in her life. And she did make a bedside promise to her dead mother, or dying mother, that she would always protect Lizzie. So I think, you know, Emma is this duty-bound woman. So we have her.
And there's this idea in that very inception, there's this idea that Lizzie is different. Lizzie needs caretaking.
Yes. Emma once said that when asked about her sister, one of the only responses she gives is, well, yes, Lizzie has always been a bit peculiar. And I just, when I read that, I'm like, oh, yeah. Peculiar is probably not the word I would use, but so there's that. So I think, and I think the way that I had thought about them being together was almost like two halves of a whole, but they were also so completely different, but they couldn't exist without each other. And so, you know, I'm quite interested in that sibling dynamic, being an older sister myself. Not that my brother and I are like them, but I wanted these two people to kind of be almost similar, but, you know, different because of all the things going on. And so then the third narrator is Bridget, the poor Irish maid who comes to work for this crazy family and did try many times to leave. And she actually relatively had it quite good. She compared to other people in it. So she didn't have to do all the chores because Mrs. Borden also did it. She got paid pretty well. She even had Sundays off, or maybe it was even half a Sunday, but no matter. Like, that was more than what a lot of servants got, and yet she still wanted to leave. So, you know, kind of, I feel like Lizzie is almost like us, Bridget is almost like us in a way, thinking like, I'm not the only one who thinks this is not right. So, so we have her, and then we have the outsider Benjamin, who is a fictional character who... He started off as someone who I wanted him to mirror Lizzie in a way, and I wanted to have a look at violence and retribution through these two characters. And yeah, he changed quite a lot from my initial conception of him, but yes, he's a bit of a red herring, but he's also he has a job to do.
Yes,
and I'll leave it at that.
Yes, don't want to give that away.
No.
The language in it is urgent and very sensory.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, tell me about the tone and your language choices.
I think I don't know where it comes from. I'm drawn to sensory overload anyway. I don't know why. Maybe I spent too much time alone as a child. But so I think I wasn't consciously going, I'm going to write a book that's going to have all of these types of elements. You know, I just think it came naturally, and that's kind of a way my brain kind of works. But I think once I realized the effect, so after I had a couple of months into it, once I realized, hang on, why am I obsessing over a particular smell or a particular sound? Once I realized I was doing that, I just thought, well, it kind of, I guess I have to amp that up, because it made me feel a bit uneasy and I wanted to crawl out of my skin. So I wanted to see, you know, what would happen. So I think that was kind of the way I do. And, you know, I could almost forget the question.
about the language and the
yeah.
Because sometimes, I mean, I think you play a lot with language, the sound, and you create new words, but they're perfectly understandable. Out of this, for me, hot, humid,
yeah,
New England summer, stiltifying in this soup that's been sitting on a stove for a week.
Delicious. I think also too, like, I never saw this book as a historical fiction, and yes, I know it's set in the past, but I think, you know, one of the reasons why I think writers do like going back to the past a lot, and certainly why I'm into it, is that it can tell us a lot about the times we live in now, or, you know, draw that kind of thing. So for it to be feeling like it could have almost taken part, you know, taken time today, I think you do need an urgency. And so I feel like, you know, whether I was thinking, oh, this is how I'm going to do it, you do need an urgency, and you do need to make it feel like it's happening right now. So I'm glad it made you feel like you couldn't settle. Yes.
No.
Yeah.
I also, as I was going to say, I think so much of, there's a wonderful, another central character actually in The Pear Tree.
Yeah, which, surprise, that's a surprise to me. I will tell you something. So the one of the original narrators of my book was The House, and I had this whole, up until I actually replaced The House with Bridget in the final year of writing it all. And so The House, very much for me, in everything that's kind of in it, like I started thinking, you know, the roof is a head, and then, you know, the eyes of the window, which is, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, and I almost saw, like, sometimes I would think of the pear arbor as arms stretching out. And I just, yeah, so I think that, you know, this whole kind of landscape just started to become human almost. And so I just kind of wanted to wrap that up. And once I'd started doing that, that's why I got rid of the house in the end, because it was there. So we didn't really need to hear its thoughts about things. But, yeah, the pear arbor is, I didn't realize I was doing that until right at the very end.
Mm.
So, yeah, things just pop in without you realizing it.
And so when you said, because I think you went and stayed there.
I did.
In the house.
Stupidest
yes.
thing I've ever done.
Why?
Well, because who else goes to, well, actually, I was going to say who else, lots of people do. I think once I found out it was a bed and breakfast, I knew I had to go, and I knew I'd have to stay in Lizzie's bedroom, because I had an idea of what I wanted the house to be, but I needed to be there as well. And I actually, I'm glad I went, because for a number of reasons. One is when you're reading the testimonies, and when she said where she was, and, you know, apparently no one heard Abby fall. She was a 200-pound woman at the time, and so it kind of just feels weird. So it was actually good to be in the situation and figure out, you know, where these things kind of took place. It was also good to just feel like you were, I mean, the house is modeled as it was in 1892, so you feel like you're walking around their house, and you feel like, you know, Mr. Borden's going to walk down the stairs at any stage. And so it was unsettling, but it was so great. But actually what made it great was the people that I got to meet who came there, because people just really love, it sounds weird to say, they love her. I mean, it's not to say that they kind of idolise her, but there is something about her and this story that just clearly actually speaks a lot to everyone.
Why do you think people like Voldemort, you know, people like Darth Vader?
Yeah.
You know, like there's, you know, there's a... She was ballsy anyway.
Yeah, well, whatever she... The very, you know, least. Yeah, exactly. And I often think, like, this is a story about a family who implodes. And I think we can all relate in some part, Mola, you know, that we all live in families. And, you know, they're sometimes not so great. And so this idea, like a Benjamin character, coming from the outside to do harm on the family is never... Can't... It's actually what happens to a family and what they can do to each other is actually, for me, more frightening. And so, yeah, I think that's just being in the house just kind of built it all up. But yeah,
because there is, in that Michel Foucault sense, the spectacle of destruction.
Mm.
And that's why I loved the title of your book, See What I Have Done.
Well, there was that. And I did want it to be, you know, it is a play on the rhyme.
Behold.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that could have easily been something that Benjamin could have said. It could, you know, all of them could have said, see what, I, you know, in all the different kind of ways.
The father could have said, yes.
Yeah, but definitely for Lizzie. I just think, yeah, she probably, well, who's to say what she did. But, you know, I do see her as someone who, for all her flaws, and God knows I don't particularly like the woman, but, yeah, she's very bold and probably proud of herself. Maybe not for, you know, doing that, but I did always see herself as, we're Bordens. We come from this great family. Of course we're wonderful, you know, and this awful tragedy has befallen us. So, yeah, I just always, you know, that, for you know, especially for someone of her time, you know, that's quite a bold thing to be in. So, you know, you have to, hats off to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, and tell me, because you spent a long time writing this book.
Too long.
Tell me about that process. Because the book you, when you discovered Lizzie Borden, or when she discovered you,
yeah,
as the case may be, you were working on something else that you abandoned.
Yes, I did. So I abandoned that. And at the time, and I always have to preface it by saying I never wrote full time on the book. I was always working or studying. Mm-hmm. And so that was partly why it took such a long time to do. But also, you know, I'd had many starts on novels before, and it kind of, they never went anywhere. And so I think partly it was me trying to figure out how to write a novel, but also as a writer trying to figure out your own voice and what you're interested in. So I just think every time I did a draft, I knew, and they were awful, but I knew that there was something in there, but I didn't know what it was. And so each draft was just an attempt to figure out what this story should and could be. And then yeah, and then I think it just takes, you know, more courage to just keep going, because once you're defeated, these characters defeated me in some ways that I couldn't back out. So I had to make it as strong as I could. So that just takes time, and I had no idea what I was doing. That's all I can say, why it took so long. And then one day, you know, I got an agent, and then, you know, it kind of goes on like that. But yeah, it took a long time. If another book takes me 10 years to write, I will not be happy. it's this ongoing thing. But I think in one way it was good that it took so long, because it just meant that I was with that family every single day. And so I felt like I was becoming one of them. And I was trapped in the house with them. And so actually it helped fuel that even more. So.
It helped you finish it. I got to get out of here.
It did. And I think one reason why I had to have multiple narrators was I always knew Lizzie was never going to give me anything. Someone had to give me something. And so I would always, and I found every character infuriating to be with for any long periods of time. So I would write Lizzie, and I'd get to the point where I'd go, I hate you. And so, and then I would go and write Emma. And that was nice for a time. And then I got sick of her. So I would keep vacillating. So I think for me, the reason why I had to have so many characters was just for my own sanity. and I think that maybe readers would feel that too, because let's be honest, no one likes these people. I don't like them, but I loved writing them. So, yeah.
And it's a great read.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind. But thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah Schmidt.
Thank you so much.